The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
We want to get straight to our first guest now on the RingCentral phone line. John Brynjolfsson, Chief Investment Officer at Armored Wolf. Thanks for joining Bloomberg Radio, John.
Good afternoon, Vonnie.
So I have to start with something just a little bit funny, since it's such a coincidence. Kid Jukes is global strategist for Societe Generale, and he was just on earlier and happened to mention in the course of the conversation that the FOMC has become pretty MIT heavy, or could become MIT heavy should Stanley Fischer be actually appointed as vice chair. But it turns out that Stanley Fischer also taught you PhD level macroeconomics back in the 80s.
He did. He did. I find it very difficult to see him installed at the Fed, just because he is such a icon in the industry. But much of the Fed has gone towards kind of a more academic, model-based approach to employment targeting and inflation targeting and the like. That may be the wrong direction, given the size of the Fed balance sheet and the institutional risks. But, you know, having said that, I have to go by what's happening, as opposed to, you know, what I think might be best and the like. And what's happening is the Fed is definitely going towards a kind of a model-driven approach to interest rates and balance sheet.
So you said you think it's going to be difficult, but you also think the likelihood is high that Fischer will be the next Fed vice chair?
No. I can't really imagine it fitting into the kind of political architecture of an institution to have someone who's that iconic, in the second seat, so to speak. It would, in some ways, create, I think, more confusion vis-a-vis leadership than would be wise. I think he does a great job as a senior statesman in terms of mentoring, not just Bernanke and others at the Fed, but people, Draghi and central bankers around the world.
So who then would be the candidate? And does it matter?
Oh, yeah. I haven't really focused on that real carefully in terms of who would be the vice chair. We obviously think that Yellen's probably going to be shoot in January and start in February 1, and I think that is key. And more to that point, I don't think there'll be a tapering coming up until she's put into office, because typically institutions like to start a new policy regime, a new policy, with a new leader, as opposed to, having the previous head kind of, changing tack towards the last meeting or two of their term.
All right, we got slightly just off the very immediate question, just because of your history with Stanley Fischer and the fact that he taught you, as well as other people that we know very well, such as Bernanke, for example. So getting straight to the question that's of the day, does the Fed taper tomorrow?
Yeah, I just can't see that happening. When the policy was started, I don't think anyone realized that it would grow as much as it did and go on for as long as it did. And the Fed balance sheet certainly is unwieldy at the current point. I'm kind of going a little bit off track here in terms of talking to the other side of the equation, but there's income inequality, which is a big issue, and a lot of thinkers believe that the Fed balance sheet has something to do with the increasing income inequality, certainly in terms of not creating jobs and in terms of creating bubbles and so forth and financial assets. Having said all that, the current policymakers at the Fed, and certainly the new appointees, are not geared towards changing tack or towards suddenly addressing these imbalances. I think they're going to be more concerned with addressing the high unemployment rate and the low inflation rate, and actually perhaps even coming up with policies that are more dovish in nature, such as putting a floor on inflation as part of their more explicit kind of guidance.
So, John, how do you invest in an environment like this? What's the hedge case, let's say?
Well, I mean, one of the opportunities we have here is that we can be relatively nimble and change our views from month to month, certainly. And right now, our views are towards the disinflation side of the equation. The inflation numbers that came out this morning were consistent with, you know, inflation relatively low and somewhat below target. There still are fiscal headwinds. There's still challenges ahead, and we don't see inflation flaring up anytime soon. So one thing that, you know, despite the idea that at some point in the future there'll be tapering, and at some point in the future interest rates will rise, as long as inflation is relatively low, we think the fundamentals are giving us a tailwind to profit from owning things like the 10-year sector, the U.S. curve. We own it through futures mostly, and that gives us really exposure somewhat inside of the 10-year sector and into the 7-year sector of the U.S. Treasury curve. So that's one of the things that we think makes sense in the current environment, knowing that, you know, as things change, we have to be ready to get out of that trade.
Sure. Now, some people would say that even the 7-year might be a little bit too far out. What's your case for the 7-year as opposed to fives or threes?
Well, I mean, you've got a number of years of protection in terms of you know, something of a commitment to 0% Fed funds rate. So despite what the Treasury is buying and selling, or the Fed is buying and selling, you know, you got the front end pinned down. I think that, you know, the biggest risks are out there in the 30-year sector, in the 20-year sector, you know, maybe in the 15-year sector. That's where the Fed has been pivoting to. That's where Operation Twist put them, and that's where the Fed's buying, you know, the largest fraction of Treasury issuance. You know, in contrast, on the front end, I think there's a little bit more security and comfort, you know, provided by that Fed funds anchor.
Okay, so in terms of allocation then, or at least, you know, risk taking, how much are you putting into the likes of Treasuries, and how much are you looking at equities and other options?
Well, you know, we try to operate at the margin, and recently, you know, at the margin, it means we've been adding to the 10-year sector. We also think, for example, gold could be very attractive. It's been on quite a slide for a number of years now, but we're getting at levels where it's kind of seems to be testing the support levels around 1,200, and in the kind of scenario that Yellen represents, gold should be very attractive. We've got the thought that a lot on the short side would start to cover going into year end, and then you've got the you know, Chinese holidays and like coming up, being supportive of gold.
So short before year end and into the Chinese New Year, and then would you stay in gold for the long term?
Well, yeah, I'm saying that we're comfortable being slightly long here and getting longer gold, because those who are shorts are going to be having to cover in those shorts towards year end, typically, and cover those shorts before the Chinese New Year starts. So we're looking more at a bullish outlook for gold.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're talking about disinflation. So you're saying that you would get into gold now, but you'd likely be, you know, holding that position for several years.
Well, I think it does represent an interesting portfolio addition, because it's kind of a hedge against some of the Fed and global monetary policies around the world, which are much more oriented towards kind of increasing money supply and increasing the amount of money in circulation, you know, with the hope of reigniting economies. But to the extent that they don't result in real growth, they're likely to result in monetary inflation.
Okay, so you haven't mentioned equities at all. Are you seeing any opportunities there, be it, you know, being short something or being short a country or long something or you know, as you say, at the margin in options?
Well, it's very difficult to be short equities. Obviously, being short equities has not been a good trade for the past 4 or 5 years. We've got a tremendous equity specialist, Brad Kern, who joined us about a year ago. And he's been really profiting more from security selection rather than directional trading. But he's got his finger on the pulse of the equity market, and he's slightly long, but I'm sure that he's ready to quickly change that to a short bias as the sentiment shifts. But he's been profiting from things like Steinway, which is benefiting from the huge wealth transfer to the very elite Chinese consumer who likes to buy Steinway pianos, for example, following the private equity investors and others who are looking for companies that have strong asset values, strong income streams, and represent, you know, interesting strategic targets.
What about then, so you're looking a little bit at China, particularly what the elite Chinese are going to be buying, I suppose, over the next decade or so. Are you concentrating on any other markets? Are you concerned at all about the little downturn that we're seeing in emerging markets now?
Well, yeah, I mean, the emerging markets got hit pretty hard last May when Bernanke started talking about tapering, and you know, by the end of June, that was pretty ugly. Certainly, the idea of tapering globally, draining money out of the financial markets, is difficult for those emerging market countries that have deficits and bad macroeconomic fundamentals. You know, we're also looking closely at Europe. France is looking weak with its PMI diverging to the downside from the rest of Europe, and the rest of Europe is relatively weak to begin with. So we think France will widen out relative to Germany. We also think Italy is at risk in terms of stress in the Eurozone. Eurozone growth is weak. Another trade related to that is that we're short Brent crude oil versus being long WTI. And right now, WTI is at about $10 to $12 discount to Brent, which we think is an anomaly that will get corrected.
So when you talk about French and Italian spreads widening, that's a trade, right? You're looking at trading those?
Sure. Yeah, that's how we're positioned within Europe. You know, I wouldn't say that we're super enthusiastic about owning German bunds, but they represent a good value relative to the more speculative, I guess, French and Italian treasuries.
How do you look at currencies when you're doing all of this? Because I presume you sort of have to take into account currency risk as well.
Yeah, well, you know, our biggest currency profits have come out of the yen, where we were short yen and long the dollar, and that profited from the extremely aggressive monetary regime shift that Abe implemented about a year ago, and that it resulted in a 15% to 20% depreciation of the yen. That's a trend that we, you know, think will stay in place as the Japanese continue to try to reflate their economy. On the euro, we've had, you know, a lot less success. Our sense is that the European economy is struggling, and that the central bank will have to, you know, aggressively ease. The ECB did ease, I guess, about a month ago, and that did provide a little bit of a help to a short euro trade. But generally, the euro has been extremely strong, and that serves as actually a real headwind to European economic growth. And with unemployment, you know, north of 12% across the eurozone, you know, it's surprising that the ECB has engineered such a strong euro.
John Brynjolfsson, thank you so much.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.